You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 18th of November, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
You know, I'm going to milk this COVID thing for as many months as I possibly can. But we're just talking how my latest book is now, you know, going to be very much delayed because of it. So I'm just pounding out one essay after another, trying to catch up. So if I'm a little goofy, more than normal, just let me know. Silence me if you need to.
Well, you're sounding good enough to me, and the work you're doing is just as good as normal. I know you were feeling a bit rough or sounding a little bit rough for the first week after, but I would say that you're right back to full guns blazing, I would say, and you've certainly picked a good subject. For today, we're going to be talking about the myth of Russian aggression today, and we're going to start with an essay by a Mary Dajewski from Spiked Online, because she summarizes what's going on, because this is just taking off again now. It's something that keeps repeating itself, so we thought we would have a look at what's happening today and also the origins of it. And she begins, she says, "Granted, memories in the era of instant media are short. But are they so short that US and European public opinion is being invited to accept, without challenge, a new round of scaremongering about Russia that comes only 6 months after the last? It was, after all, as recently as April that most of Europe was on tenterhooks over reports that 100,000 Russian troops were massing on Ukraine's eastern border, preparing for, well, it was never quite spelled out what they were preparing for. It could have been an invasion and a takeover of the whole of Ukraine, the installation of a puppet government in the Donbass, or the annexation or integration, as Russia might have preferred to say, of that territory by the Russian Federation on the model of Crimea in 2014, or just a new offensive against Ukrainian government forces in the region." And it really does seem that they just seem to roll this out every 6 months or so. They claim that Russia is about to invade the Ukraine, and Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine, he starts saying Russia's about to invade. And now they've got Britain that seems to be getting involved in this instant. Matt, what do you make of what she's saying here about this last false scare that we had?
Well, keep in mind, you know, something about Ukraine. The economy essentially doesn't exist. It's kind of like a much bigger version of Albania. It has the potential of being one of the dominant economic powers in the world. More people per capita with advanced degrees than any other place on earth. But they're having a huge brain drain because of this absolute disastrous economy. And the truth is that they don't really do anything for the West. They don't do anything for NATO or for the European Union. So they live on foreign aid. But pretty soon people are going to realize we're not throwing money that we're never going to see again at this place. So the only card they can play is that Russia is going to invade. And God knows what they'll come up with and say. You know, the point is, it's like Israel and the U.S. They invade us. That's essentially invading you. Of course, any invasion talk is laughable. And it takes a hell of a lot more than 100,000 men to invade a place that large. And so, but because the only hope that Ukraine has to keep the aid flowing is constant Russian threats. It's like Israel. The only way they can justify this huge amount of aid is we're under attack 24 hours a day. And that means you're under attack. And that's how essentially Ukrainian politics is. Not to mention the simple fact, of course, that Ukraine is not an independent country, hasn't been for a very long time. It's a dependency of the United States and the European Union. Nothing is autonomous there, since everything they have really comes from aid from the West. The profitable industries are in the East, which, thank God, fought their way out of the control of Western powers back in 2014. So they're struggling in every way. But when you don't produce anything that the West wants, well, other than sex slaves, you know, they're a transit point for drugs. That's pretty much about it. All they have is this constant threat to talk about, to keep aid money and attention on them. On the other hand, of course, NATO and the West need an enemy. They need an ideological enemy. And finally, keep in mind, this was never spoken of with when the Soviet Union existed. You didn't have this constant, you know, right-wingers talked about it. But the regime talked about peace and peaceful coexistence and, you know, disarmament, reducing weaponry when it came to the Soviet Union. Nationalist Russia, Eurasian Russia, very different story. Now they're the enemy who has to be destroyed.
Well, let's have a look at what the reality was as regards this scare. Not only did nothing happen, but also two rather large clarifications emerged. The first was that there was not and never had been 100,000 Russian troops amassing on Ukraine's border. The vast majority were at their bases many kilometres away. And second, the much smaller number who were moving around were likely to be doing so in response to reports of Ukrainian troops mustering for a spring offensive, new weapons deliveries from the UK and the US, and some rather extensive NATO exercises being conducted in the Black Sea and to the west of Ukraine. As is so often the case, what was presented as an aggressive stance on the part of Russia was only half the story. The other half was what the US, the UK and NATO were doing, not 100 kilometres from Russia's borders. Once you factor this in, you might just conclude that Russia was doing no more than taking prudent precautions and that any troop movements were primarily defensive. And we pointed this out before, Matt, haven't we? The same thing goes on in the South China Seas. And I believe in India, between India and China as well, we have all this interference. The British or the Americans will go into an area they're not supposed to go. And then when there's a response to that, they'll claim, oh, it's Russian aggression. That's the same thing that's going on here, isn't it?
We've had show after show on just that topic. It's almost exactly once a month the Western powers will create an incident. You know, they'll fly a dangerous spy plane right over Russian airspace or close to it. And when the Russians respond, they write back and say that, you know, we're under attack, we're scared, we didn't know what to do, panicking, all that kind of thing. They do this all the time. We'll be talking about another incident in that respect a bit later. But I suspect that even if Russia had any intention in bringing Ukraine back into its orbit again, they could probably do it maybe with a soccer team. That government would collapse immediately. They would need a couple of squads of men to do that. Anything. If they were taken over by Russia, their economy would immediately improve, just like Crimea's did. Now, I don't think that necessarily should happen, but I don't think it would take very much to convince Ukraine that they're far better off as a dependency of Russia than anything else. Right now, they're a fourth world country. Well, I'm not exactly sure that even in much of the western part of the country, and you know the northern part of the country, they, you know, what are they getting out of this so-called independent government, this dependency of the U.S. and the EU? What are they doing for them? What's the point of this alleged independence when they could produce nothing? Ukraine has such potential wealth. They were the electronic center of the old Soviet Empire. So much potential. This independent government, so-called, is a disaster in every way. It's a pure oligarchy, dependent on the West for assistance and interference. That's all they're getting. So if Russia wanted to take them over, they could snap their fingers.
Well, I can remember when Crimea was reunited with Russia, there was a big increase in the pensions and the benefits. So clearly that it would be the same for Ukraine. They have a very, very low exchange rate there. Well, we're also seeing the problems in Belarus being linked to this. Part of what we are seeing and hearing today is an almost exact reprise of what we just spoke about, even to the troop numbers supposedly on the move, but there are some differences. This time it is not just Ukraine's borders that are supposedly under threat. The Western fear-mongering also seems more orchestrated, with the first warnings briefed by the Secretaries of State and Defence in the US. These were picked up by the UK's outgoing Defence Chief, General Sir Nick Carter, before Boris Johnson then promised to support Ukraine against the big bad Russians in his Lord Mayor's banquet speech. It might also be noted that the US seems to have made special efforts to get Ukraine's president on board. Volodymyr Zelensky has in the past tended to play down others' excitement about imminent Russian attacks, but last week he too warned of ominous Russian troop movements, citing US intelligence reports. The other big difference is the migrant crisis currently playing out on the Belarus-Poland border. Despite zero evidence that this confused and distressing situation has anything whatsoever to do with Russia, many of those peddling the warnings about massed Russian troops poised to invade the Ukraine detect the not-so-hidden hand of Russia here too. Their argument goes that Belarus and its illegitimate president, Alexander Lukashenko, can do nothing without Russia's backing, which is wrong, that Putin is a big friend of Lukashenko, which is even more wrong, and that the whole sorry mess is part of a longer-term Russian plan to bring a Russia-Belarus union into effect and to destabilize the EU and the West in general, which, if true at all, is rebounding badly. All the signs, such as they are, point to the migrant crisis as an exclusively Belarusian project dreamt up by Lukashenko in the hope of embarrassing the EU, engineering the removal of sanctions and forcing Brussels to deal with him as president. All that Russia has so far done is to have offered some sort of mediation, so far rejected, before disassociating itself very publicly from Lukashenko when he threatened to block Russia's EU-bound gas supplies. None of these moves suggests the Kremlin's malign hand at work. And that really quite surprised me that Lukashenko did that, because, I mean, that really is not something he's going to do if he's allied with Putin, is to threaten to shut off the gas. Hasn't Ukraine got a bit of a problem with gas supplies from Russia as well, Matt? Do they owe Russia lots of money for gas, I think, don't they?
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons that Ukraine complains about the possibility of a Russian invasion, is that they're constantly in international courts owing billions and billions. If the West considers Russia a threat, they're going to either pay the bill or just, you know, pretend that it's not there. This is part of Ukraine's plan. But you notice here, there's one line here that really makes me laugh, and it's about Zelensky, that he warned of Russian troop movements recently, citing U.S. intelligence reports. In other words, the president of Ukraine has to go to American intelligence to decide whether or not there's going to be an invasion of his country, which is another way of saying that U.S. intelligence told him to get on board, that there is, you know, this possibility. You know, the Russian military setup near Ukraine. I mean, you have the Second Army Corps close by. You have the First Army Corps. You have the 20th Army a bit south. You have the 49th Army. These have been there for a very long time. And the worst part of it, of course, is that Russia is surrounded by NATO bases. Most of the Warsaw Pact is now a member of NATO, which is something NATO promised they wouldn't do many years ago. NATO was always on an invasion footing. But understand that, you know, usually when these people talk, they are projecting their own ideology. All of a sudden, conspiracy theories are okay when it's applied to Russia. This is all big, elaborate conspiracy, where if it was applied to the U.S., it would be screamed at and yelled at. With the Russian case, it's the exact opposite. Conspiracies are okay. And, you know, Johnson's law being what it is, even well-educated people don't know the first thing about Belarus. They're told that they're allies of Putin, so I guess they are. But Putin, Lukashenko, as I've been talking about for years, is a nationalist in every sense of the word, one of the most popular politicians on the planet. He uses Putin when he needs him and the West when he needs them. He's a very adroit politician. And so, but his ideology, his principles are very firm. So to think that he's some lackey, and I'm not sure why, if he was just a lackey of Putin, why he would want a Russia-Belarus union. apparently it already exists. I mean, you can't even take this theory, even if you want to make it sound rational, you can't do it.
I think Lukashenko pointed out a while back that Putin had far too many Jews around him, and Putin was most upset by that. And he certainly wouldn't be saying things like that if he was in an alliance with him. Well, let's have a look at what this author thinks the explanation for this is. She says, of course, for those who see Russia as always and forever a danger to the West, such thinking dovetails nicely with the new alarm about an imminent Russian offensive against Ukraine. It does not, though, explain why that particular strand of scaremongering is suddenly coming back. Let's dispense with the obvious explanation, that Russia indeed plans to invade Ukraine. Why would anyone, least of all Russia, plan a military offensive in the heart of Europe at the start of winter? And why would it jeopardize approval for its Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which would surely be forfeit in the event of any Russian move against Ukraine? It does not make sense. So what might? First, the US administration has been quietly mending fences with Russia, and a new summit is planned. Washington's hawks have to be convinced that Joe Biden won't sell out US interests. So some trumpeting about a Russian threat wouldn't come amiss. Second, with NATO's extension of operations into the Pacific theater not going well, a Russian threat always offers NATO a new sense of purpose, especially among its East and Central European members. Third, Europe, especially Germany, needs Russian gas, and prices have soared in part because of the EU's own missteps. But Russia has to be shown that it can't dictate terms. There has to be a bit of hardball before Nord Stream 2 gets its license. And fourth, closer to home, global Britain is in the throes of a belated love-in with Ukraine, which includes not just military training, but building ships and supplying weapons. The Black Sea incident in June, which we will talk about in a minute, demonstrated that the UK is not above indulging in risky machismo. Now, as well as sending a small military detachment to help Poland secure its border with Belarus, it has 600 Special Forces personnel set to be dispatched to Ukraine. Take away an imminent Russian threat and the wisdom of subsidising Ukraine's war machine, let alone fermenting tensions in the Black Sea, might draw more public scrutiny than it currently does. Many disparate interests might thus help to explain why a new Russian threat is being conjured up right now. But exaggerating a threat can be just as dangerous as neglecting a real one. The so far non-military crisis at the Belarus-Polish border introduces a whole new element of very human unpredictability that demands restraint rather than hype from all sides. I think she has a good point about Nord Stream 2. It's not like Russia is going to try and rock the boat. They really want to get that Nord Stream pipeline going, and they're hoping that that's going to calm things down. Once there's a bit of reciprocity there, that they're sending the gas to Europe, Europe are paying for it. You know, they're hoping that things are going to calm down, I think. What do you think of her explanations here, Matt?
Well, I like a lot of what she says. She's trying to make she's making a case against any kind of Russian aggression, but trying to put the NATO's point of view in rational terms is extremely difficult. She mentions what I've been talking about here quite a bit, that there has to be this imminent threat to Ukraine to justify the constant, the tens of billions a year from private and public sources that's thrown into this country and, of course, never seen again. And, of course, the ultimate provocation, talking about bringing Ukraine into NATO. And NATO, Ukraine couldn't be a part of NATO in a formal sense because their entire military establishment, which is very small, which was humiliated against the Eastern Nationalist Revolutionaries and was defeated badly, still uses, you know, Warsaw Pact equipment. So for them to switch over to NATO would take billions and billions of dollars. The whole GDP is something like $100 billion and shrinking rapidly, has been shrinking for a very long time. But NATO will simply bring them in for the sake of creating this this provocation. What Russia will do then, that's a totally different story. So it's bad enough you have all of the Warsaw Pact as a member of NATO, constant threat to Russia. But now you have both Britain, well, the EU, NATO, and the US, financing huge shipments of weaponry to Ukraine. That army, of course, as I said, was humiliated in the 2014-15 war. They simply refused to fight. They had no ability. They had no discipline. And the men in the revolutionary movement in the East defeated them really without a whole lot of problems. So I'm not really sure what benefit they think this is going to be. But sending weaponry, and we'll talk about here in a minute, the shipping agreement with Great Britain, rebuilding this navy, is something that's an extraordinary provocation. Of course, very few people are talking about. And I don't know if you heard, but the U.S. Navy just commissioned a ship, I believe it's a tanker, named after Harvey Milk, the famous gay rights activist from San Francisco who was shot in 1978. But of course, I predicted that a long time ago.
Yeah, I had heard of that. But so just something that I want to pick up on there is surely, I mean, Ukraine was a part, you know, it was a part of the Soviet Union. I mean, did it really have any military to speak of when it was allied to Russia? I mean, Britain is now making warships for them and America's giving them military. But what is their army actually made up from? Is it made up from these militias that were paid to take down the previous government, Matt?
Well, they had to really almost create this from scratch, since the Soviet army at some point dissolved and had to pull back. They're using a lot of old Soviet equipment. They're using the old ranking system. These were bits and pieces that they were able to cobble together. There's simply no money there. It has never been very large. Navies are extremely expensive to put together. They're not able to do that. They don't have the sailors anyway. And spending this kind of money, even back then or now, you know, for an impoverished country is ridiculous. And I can't imagine even the most nationalistic Ukrainian citizen is happy that public money is going to this, but they can't pay pensions, that the currency is pretty much worthless. So, yeah, building that army, it was, you know, it's always been just cobbled together. You see the same thing in the Baltics. The Soviet pulls out, the Soviet Union pulls out. But at least they switched over to NATO. They were much better off economically. Ukraine still has the old Soviet weaponry and mentality. And so bringing them into NATO is not quite as bad as Albania. That's just a joke, an actual joke. But it would cost so much and it would end up being paid mostly by, I think, the American and the European taxpayer.
Well, you'd imagine there'd probably be some residual loyalty to the Soviet Union or residual loyalty to Russia rather than to Ukraine as well. Well, as I said, we'll have another look at this incident that took place in June, and we did talk about this at the time, I think. A Russian patrol ship and fighter jet have fired warning shots after the British destroyer HMS Defender violated the country's border in the Black Sea. The UK embassy's defence attaché has been summoned by officials in Moscow. According to Russia's Ministry of Defence, the British naval ship entered the country's territorial waters at 11:52 a.m. local time and travelled 3 kilometres inside the frontier near Cape Fiolent in Crimea. The peninsula is not recognised by the United Kingdom as Russian land, and London believes it to be illegally occupied Ukrainian territory. Shortly before the Defence Ministry publicised the incident, Russia's top army chief, Valery Gerasimov, told a Moscow security conference that NATO naval activity near the Russian borders had significantly increased. Ships equipped with high-precision long-range missile weapons operate almost on a permanent basis in the Black and Baltic Seas, he said, calling the actions clearly provocative. Russian Senator Sergei Sekov, in comments to RIA Novosti, decried the warship's movements as a flagrant violation of international norms, noting that the actions could provoke a serious conflict. The HMS Defender is an air defence destroyer launched in 2009. Designed primarily for anti-aircraft and anti-missile warfare, it is currently conducting missions in the Black Sea. Before the recent incident, the ship was docked in the Ukrainian port of Odessa, where it played host to a signing ceremony attended by British Minister for Defence Procurement Jeremy Quinn and Deputy Defence Minister of Ukraine Alexander Mironyuk. London and Kiev agreed a deal for the UK to supply warships to Ukraine, and with the British also pledging to help the country construct Black Sea naval bases. Following the incident, Britain's Ministry of Defence denied that any warning shots were fired at the HMS Defender, claiming that the vessel is conducting innocent passage through Ukrainian territorial waters in accordance with international law, and the Russian shots were just part of a pre-planned gunnery exercise. No shots were directed at HMS Defender, and we do not recognise the claim that bombs were dropped in her path, the statement said. I mean, that's rather a suspicious coincidence there, isn't it? They have this big signing agreement with Ukraine to supply warships, and the very next day, the British vessel that was there is heading off into Russian waters to provoke the Russians. What else is there to this this incident here, Matt, that we should know about?
Well, despite the fact that even the Royal Navy says that these warning shots, bombs weren't fired, the press still says it does. The press is talking about this. This is back in June, and this issue is still going on. We've had all these shows on the constant deliberate provocations. They're talking about, 100,000 Russian soldiers in military bases that have always been there, close to Ukraine, as some sort of buildup. And now they're bringing highly armed destroyers with the purpose of building an enemy fleet against Russia, despite the country having very little money. And I told you that this military buildup is going to be at the expense of the taxpayer in the West. Somehow that's not provocative. They will do everything they possibly can to provoke a war. A war, of course, that the West simply can't win no matter what. But there was these war games. The war games are being done because of Western provocations in an area that they have absolutely no right to be in. They have no interest there. You know, it's like the 19th century never ended. So they made sure that they were in it wasn't near it, but close enough that they can then claim that they came under attack. But even there, the evidence is so distant from the truth that even the Royal Navy had to say, okay, nothing really happened. And even the president of Ukraine had to admit it. That's really a ridiculous claim. But the American press is still talking about it. This is a third world country that has no money. Now they're going to build up this massive fleet for a non-existent threat. And I think ultimately, when it comes down to it, there is this ideological battle, globalism versus nationalism. Ukraine has been on the nationalist side up until really the 2000s. And it's almost as if, as I said, people would welcome any kind of Russian influence. They're dying to have what the Crimea has. Simply having the ruble as their currency meant all of their salaries went up because the hryvnia has no value. There's no economy to back it up. Its value is granted to it by Western banks. And so you have an impoverished country that produces nothing of value. The only thing that they possibly can do is serve as a base for ships on the Black Sea. And it will be, even if they have a so-called Ukrainian Navy, it is going to be, in essence, a British or an American base pointed right at Russia. These were heavily armed ships deliberately coming very close to Crimea. They're looking for a war. They're looking for some excuse to do damage to a rival that's beating them on every other front.
Well, that Black Sea base, I mean, that is Russia's main naval base. I mean, having Ukraine build a base next to it with British ships is the equivalent of Russia having a military base right next to the Pentagon. I mean, that is a huge provocation in itself. But finally here, we have a first-hand account of what went on back in June by Jonathan Beale, the British defence correspondent. And he says, I am on board the warship in the Black Sea. The crew were already at action stations as they approached the southern tip of Russian-occupied Crimea. Weapons systems on board the Royal Navy destroyer had already been loaded. This would be a deliberate move to make a point to Russia. HMS Defender was going to sail within the 12-mile limit of Crimea's territorial waters. The captain insisted he was only seeking safe passage through an internationally recognised shipping lane. Two Russian Coast Guard ships that were shadowing the Royal Navy warship tried to force it to alter its course. At one stage, one of the Russian vessels closed in to about 100 metres. Increasingly hostile warnings were issued over the radio, including one that said, "If you don't change course, I will fire." And we did hear some firing in the distance, but they were believed to be well out of range. As HMS Defender sailed through the shipping lane, it was buzzed by Russian jets. The captain, Vincent Owen, said the ship detected more than 20 military aircraft nearby. Commander Owen said his mission was confident but non-confrontational. Russia said the incident happened just after midday local time in the Black Sea near Cape Fiolent in the south of Crimea. According to the Russian military, HMS Defender was told to change course, and when it failed to do so, a Russian border patrol ship sent several warning shots. About 10 minutes later, a military jet dropped warning bombs in the path of the destroyer. So we have the official response from the British military, which says this didn't happen. And then we actually have the British defence correspondent who is saying, well, actually, yes, this did happen. I was actually on the ship itself. I mean, it's just incredible that they would just play like this, trying to wind Russia up. And, you know, what the sort of terrible things that could happen. It's just, you have to rely upon the Russians being sensible and not wanting to start a war, really, don't you? You just have to be thankful for that, I think, Matt. What are your final thoughts?
Well, Putin and Xi in China, their restraint and ability to play the West and beat them at their own game is absolutely, it's superhuman. Russia would have every right to fight back against being surrounded and attacked and having sanctions put on it for imaginary issues. But this guy, I included this guy's testimony because even though he's an embedded journalist, he's saying that it was a deliberate provocation. They were loading their weapons. This destroyer was loaded with things from very expensive weaponry to give to or sell to the Ukrainians. Now, the war games is probably what he may have been talking about, with well out of range things. I'm not sure if that's what he meant by the bombs. You don't drop warning bombs. Bombs don't work that way. Shots from either missile or machine gun, that makes more sense. I don't think he knows what a bomb is. But this is a contradictory thing, but he has to admit this was a deliberate provocation. When an embedded journalist says that, he is telling the truth. And the point is, of course, deliberately to get Russia to hit the ship or to do something, you know, to capture it, whatever, and to then give the West a reason to actually fight openly. And again, I'll say it again, the West simply can't win that war.
It's incredible, isn't it? They're going right in 12 miles close to the shore and they say, right, load all the weapons up as well so that we've got a real provocation here and we'll see what Russia does. Thank God for Russia's patience. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.